All rise. The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case is 2020-648, the State of Ohio versus Robert W. Bethel. For the appellant, Ms. Troutman.
Thank you. Chief Justice and Associate Justices, may it please the court. My name is Rachel.
Excuse me, would you pull the microphone a little closer to you so we can hear you better? Thank
you. Certainly. Is that better, Your Honor?
That's much better. Thank you.
I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, please. So this case is about whether the state can withhold evidence that Mr. Bethel did not commit this crime and then fault him for his failure to find and file it soon enough. It's also about the fact that the lower courts in Ohio are misapplying United States Supreme Court precedent when it comes to Brady. Banks versus Dretke makes clear that there is no due diligence requirement on the defense. This court needs to bring Ohio in line with the constitutional requirements and instruct that suppression under Brady is equal to the avoidable prevention prong under 33B, Criminal Rule 33B, and Ohio Revised Code 2953.23A1. Brady requires the prosecution to disclose favorable material evidence at the time of trial. And Banks versus Dretke makes clear, again, that there is no corresponding burden on the defendant. The state here withheld two pieces of exculpatory evidence, two separate reports, each of them exculpatory, and together they are exponentially exculpatory. Both of them are statements from informants. One heard Donald Langbein make statements that included an admission to being involved in this crime. And the other one was Jeremy Chavis. Ronald Withers heard Jeremy Chavis say that he and his cousin committed this crime. Robert Bethel is not Jeremy Chavis's cousin, and he has never been alleged to be his cousin.
Counselor, assuming that you find that was erroneous, do we affirm the Court of Appeals anyway? Didn't Mr. Bethel confess to the crime?
Mr. Bethel did offer a proffered statement, but the reason why it's material, regardless of that, there are many reasons, Your Honor. First, we believe the prosecution was even unaware of these statements. And in light of the record, if you look at particularly a pretrial hearing in August of 2002, and the prosecution goes through what the exculpatory evidence is, and then even at trial, he says there is zero evidence that Donald Langbein committed this crime. So if you take into account that the prosecution was unaware of these two police reports, would they have indicted Robert Bethel with a double murder had they had two informants saying that Jeremy Chavis and Donald Langbein were the ones who committed this crime? But even if they had, defense counsel said that they would not have advised their client to enter into that proffered statement. He was at a turning point in a situation that is difficult to find one that would be more coercive. He is on the eve of trial with two attorneys who admittedly did zero investigation. His attorneys, his investigator, his mitigation specialist, and his mother are begging him to take a deal, and the only way he can do that is if he makes a proffered statement. So even assuming he makes the proffered statement and goes to trial, those two pieces of evidence, would the state have used Donald Langbein as their star witness?
Well, but isn't the evaluation not whether he would have pled guilty, but had this information been available, the probability of his still being found guilty of the crime and being sentenced to death?
No, Your Honor. The test is whether the court does not have to find, under Weary versus Cain and Brady progeny, the court does not have to find that Mr. Bethel would have been acquitted. It simply has to find that there is undermined confidence in the outcome. And if the jury had his confession and the jury had these two statements, could they have further understood, you know, that there a quarter of wrongful convictions in this country come from false confessions? So in light of that evidence, would they have viewed that confession in a different light? And would they have taken Donald Langbein, who was the state's main witness, the reason after 4 years they indicted Mr. Bethel, would they have used him and relied on him to convict Robert Bethel of double murder and sentence him to death? And I think the answer is no.
Counsel, tell me how this trial court had subject matter jurisdiction under the statute.
Well, this court has found in State versus Davis that when a new trial motion provides subject matter jurisdiction for a defendant that they could file. So we filed under both the Criminal Rule 33, which we were authorized to do, as well as under 2953.23. And under 2953.23, the defendant has to demonstrate that he was unavoidably prevented and that the evidence either would have, no reasonable juror would have convicted him or would have sentenced him to death. We believe we've met all of those prongs, Your Honor. The state complains of res judicata and piecemeal litigation in this case, but there is one surefire way they could have avoided piecemeal litigation, and that would be to disclose all of the suppressed evidence, material favorable evidence, at the time of trial. At no point could Mr. Bethel then have even litigated a Brady claim. But beyond that, this court's case law and Banks versus Dretke supports the idea that this court should consider it on the merits and not apply a res judicata bar. This court in State versus Simpkins and a multitude of other cases, this court talked about how res judicata is a rule of fundamental and substantial justice that is to be applied in particular situations as fairness and justice require, and that is not to be applied so rigidly as to defeat the ends of justice so as to work an injustice. It would be an injustice here to bar Mr. Bethel the ability to litigate his claim on the merits because of res judicata. Moreover, if you look at the facts in Banks versus Dretke, the defendant there filed his third post-conviction petition, and his third post-conviction petition was based on an affidavit that wasn't even signed and included some facts that alleged a Brady violation. 7 years later, in federal court, he supplemented that with two signed affidavits from state's witnesses that alleged more evidence of Brady violation. Then in discovery, he found more evidence of another Brady violation. So the district court and the Fifth Circuit, they denied him relief and found that he wasn't diligent in state court in prosecuting those claims. And they also denied him on materiality basis. And they also found that that additional Brady evidence, he never even raised it. He didn't even file an additional Brady claim in federal court. But the Supreme Court reversed. And the Supreme Court found that Banks prosecutors represented at trial and in state post-conviction that the state had held nothing back. And it was not incumbent on Banks to demonstrate that the state had misrepresented its evidence. Similarly here, Mr. Bethel filed his motion in 2009, and the state and their response represented that they had reviewed all of their trial files, and they reviewed all of the public records that had been provided to Mr. Bethel. At no point did they say there was this corresponding report that bolsters the statement from Shannon Williams. Instead, what they did was represent to the court that there was nothing to see here, that Mr. Bethel was making something out of nothing. And they claimed that the information showed that Langbein was even discussing another crime, or he was just referring to the fact that he was being an informant. Mr. Bethel had no reason to believe that the state would not come forth with that information if that was in its files. So either one of two things happened. Either it wasn't in its file yet, and again, like I said, we believe the prosecution didn't have that record, didn't have those documents, that the police suppressed it. Or it was, and they misrepresented it to the court and to Mr. Bethel. I prefer to believe it's the former.
But even if the ATF report is res judicata, when you consider it with, I think it's Form 86, that's a different story, correct?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Those two documents, under Kyles versus Whitley, this court has to consider all suppressed evidence cumulatively. And those two documents together especially are, again, exponentially stronger. Mr. Bethel had no reason to know that his co-defendant was out there confessing to people, and that the police had in their possession a document in which Mr. Chavis said that he and his cousin committed this crime. He had no reason to know that existed, no reason to know he had that independent ability to prove that to his jury. Instead, defense went forward with Mr. Bethel's self-serving testimony, which this court knows has much less weight. So when you look at the Brady elements, one of the main reasons we think that the prosecution didn't have this report, for starters, it's Franklin County, and they don't overly indict death cases. And they indicted Mr. Bethel with a double murder with these two police reports. Then at trial, they told the jury that there was, quote, zero evidence that Donald Langbein had anything to do with this case. I don't believe these two prosecutors would have said that to that jury if that were the case, if they knew about those two reports.
But I want to ask you another question, though. The whole situation with the Brady violation is, you're making some good points, but the evidence, if it had been available, do you think that it would put the whole case in such a different light that it would undermine the confidence in the verdict?
100%, Your Honor.
But what about Mr. Bethel's confessions and the corroboration of those by other witnesses?
Well, two things. First, there are many Brady cases in which a defendant has confessed and it is still material. Again, we don't have to show that he would have been acquitted. But this court needs to look at that confession in light of the facts before it. Again, 29% of wrongful convictions come from false confessions. And Mr. Bethel was facing a death penalty trial, with two attorneys who were unprepared. But we also know from his affidavit of his attorneys, Mr. Ron Janes, that they would not have advised him to plead guilty and to give that proffered statement. They would, and that's the only reason he did it. The record is very clear that they talked him into making that statement.
And so I understand, with the record in the way that it is, though, there were statements, if we believe the witnesses, or if apparently the jury did, not a jury, but there are statements where the witnesses basically corroborated what his confession was made on the advice of counsel. So what do we do with that?
The only witness that corroborated Mr. Bethel's proffered statement was Donald Langbein. And Donald Langbein had a reason to do so. If Donald Langbein and Jeremy Chavis were the ones who committed this crime, then it was just like in D'Ambrosio v. Bagley, it was very beneficial for him to point the finger at Mr. Bethel. But there was another, sorry, Your Honor.
No, I was thinking more about Teresa Campbell, Bethel's former girlfriend, and both Langbein testified that he confessed to them on separate occasions that he murdered Hawks and Reynolds. So how do we handle that?
First, I urge this court to read the testimony of Teresa Cobb Campbell and decide for yourself if that alone is enough on which to base this death sentence and conviction. And I don't think it is. For one thing, it wasn't even enough for the state to indict him. Ms. Cobb Campbell is very mentally ill. She was on a series of antipsychotic medication, and even her own mother in post-conviction submitted an affidavit saying that she called the court and told them not to let her daughter testify because she makes things up in her head. And Ms. Cobb Campbell had an inability to identify Mr. Bethel at first during the trial, which she looked around the courtroom and eventually found him at the defense counsel's table. And the prosecution admitted that if they had known about her, because the search warrant for Mr. Bethel's house was based on her statement, and they admitted that had they known about her mental health issues, that she would not have been a sufficient source for them to have searched Mr. Bethel's house. But even if we leave her testimony unscathed with all of that, it's still enough to undermine confidence in the outcome. We have two unbiased, unrelated witnesses who said at two separate times that Donald Langbein said he was involved in this crime and that Jeremy Chavis said he was involved in this crime with his cousin. So would the jury have heard that and credited only Teresa Cobb Campbell's testimony over that? And I don't think it would. And I certainly don't think we can have confidence in the outcome of this trial. Your Honor, at this point, I see that I've only a couple minutes reserved for rebuttal, so I'm gonna save those.
How would the jury have heard that statement?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
How would the jury have heard the Withers statement?
Well, first of all, this court said in state.
It's a hearsay statement. It wouldn't have come into evidence.
In State versus Brown, this court said that even inadmissible hearsay evidence recognized that was highly prejudicial and should have been disclosed.
Okay, but you just said if the jury had heard that statement, but how would the jury have heard that statement?
The testimony of Detective Calais could have been challenged with these police reports. They could have come in through Detective Calais. He, in fact, sat at the prosecution's table, and while the state's
it wouldn't have come in for the truth of the matter. Maybe you could have brought in about the investigation. I don't. I mean,
absolutely, Your Honor, and that under Crowley.
Well, not absolutely, right? That's a real stretch. I mean, you have a hearsay statement that's not admissible, and you have a very tenuous theory on which you think it might come in.
I don't think it's a tenuous theory, Your Honor, at all. And I think Kyles versus Whitley makes that very clear. I think that they talk about the way that you can undermine the police investigation with the evidence that had not been uncovered and why that is material. And I think that's the case here, most definitely, even if that's the only way it could have come in.
And your client testified at trial, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And from what I can gather, he admitted during the defense of the case that he was with Chavis, Hawks, and Reynolds on the evening of the murder.
Yes, Your Honor.
So when you put all those together, the jury was able to make inferences. And I guess I'm still looking at sort of that balancing of, clearly I think even the states conceded that there were problems with Brady, but then looking at the evidence, did those problems create enough of a difference that it would have affected the verdict?
Even if he was with them that evening, if Jeremy Chavis and Donald Langbein shot and killed them, would Mr. Bethel have been convicted of their double murder and sentenced to death? And I think the jury would have struggled with that. And I don't think the state would have indicted him for that had they known that Jeremy Chavis and Donald Langbein committed those crimes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Gilbert.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court, the state agrees that a defendant has no duty to exercise reasonable diligence to find his own Brady material. We're in agreement with that legal point. The problem here is that the defendant failed to present sufficient evidence to prove a cognizable Brady claim. Even if you agree with the defense that Williams and Withers' statements implicate Chavis and Langbein in these murders, and even if you agree that the state failed to turn over the information in those statements, and even if you agree that none of the defendant's lawyers or investigators learned of the information in those statements, again, we're not conceding any of those points, but even if you agree with all that, the fact still remains that the defendant's Brady claim was facially deficient because the defendant presented no evidence, none, as to that the defendant himself lacked the knowledge of the information contained in the statements. And in fact, just the opposite, the content of the statements affirmatively prove that the defendant did know the information in those statements. It's not just the defendant knows of his non-involvement of the crimes. He knew the specific information contained in the statements that if you believe the defense's new exculpatory theory, the defendant would have known because the statements put him at the scene as the driver. He would have known that Chavis and Langbein were the shooters, and that knowledge in itself defeats the defense's Brady claim. And
what would he have done with that knowledge, though? And because it was unbeknownst to him that there were those statements.
Right. Well, the defense wants to focus the Brady analysis on the existence of the statements to Williams and Withers. I don't think that's the right analysis because the existence of the statements themselves don't have any evidentiary value. It's been touched on a little bit already this morning. I'll start with the Williams statement in the ATF report. Williams has not submitted any affidavit. We have no idea what Williams would ever testify to if he was ever called to the stand or if he ever agreed to testify. All the defense has is Oswald describing what Williams said, describing what Langbein said. That's two layers of hearsay. That doesn't come in at all. The Williams statement has no evidentiary value. Moving on to the Withers statement. We do have an affidavit from Withers. But even if you put him on the stand, all he can testify to is what Chavis said. And that is inadmissible hearsay also. Maybe Chavis' statement could come in under 804B3 insofar as he's admitting to shooting an already dead body. I guess that's a confession to abuse of a corpse. But insofar as Chavis is inculpating other people, Those are not statements against his own penal interests. That's inadmissible hearsay that doesn't come in for the truth of the matter asserted.
So it doesn't come in for the truth of the matter asserted, but that had that been known to the defense attorney, the police officers could have been questioned about these statements, correct?
No, I don't agree with that, Your Honor. The defense wants to say, well, okay, they're not coming in for the truth of the matter asserted. They come in under this limited evidentiary doctrine that courts have recognized to explain the police investigation. I don't buy that either, because they don't want to explain the police investigation. They want to criticize it. Usually when you're talking about out-of-court statements coming in to explain what steps an officer took, it's usually because, you know, the officer presents a photo array with someone's picture in it, and you need to explain why that person's photo was in the picture or something like that. That's not where the defense is going with this. They want to admit these out-of-court statements to criticize the investigation, and that's not the same thing. And I'll also add to that point, if they go down that road, and even if some of these out-of-court statements would be admissible for that purpose, that would swing the door wide open for the state to admit its own out-of-court statements to support the police's investigation. And I'll point the court to the 10th District's 2003 direct appeal opinion in the Chavis case. In that, when you read the opinion, two witnesses testified in that case, a fellow by the name of Ted Palladino and Jeremy Chavis's own brother, Chavaldis. Both Ted Palladino and Chavaldis testified that Jeremy told them that he and Bethel were the shooters. So Jeremy Chavis is all over the place. And so if they admit Chavis's statements to Withers, we admit Chavis's statement to Palladino and Chavaldis.
None of these statements are being offered for the truth of the matter.
Nothing's being offered for the truth. We're right back where we started.
But Mr. Gilbert, what about the fact, though, that Mr. Bethel's defense counsel didn't know about what was in these two documents, and they had testified that their advice to their client would have been different. They surmised, based upon what they knew from the evidence that they had, that he should go ahead and confess to try to avoid the death penalty. They said had they known this other information was available, they would have taken a completely different approach. How do we deal with that?
A few points on that point, Your Honor. First off, again, the existence of the statements themselves have no evidentiary value. So I don't think they enter into the calculus on the trial.
No, and I'm not talking about evidence. I'm talking about for counsel to make an informed advice to clients.
Right, and my point is that if the statements don't come in as evidence at all, then it's hard to see how counsel's advice would have been any different. But even if they did advise the defendant different.
You understand work product. You really can't. I mean, honestly, not everything that an attorney looks at, even you, in preparing your case, is something you're going to introduce at trial, but it does inform your decision on doing your best job to represent your client. So how do we fashion a decision that takes that into account?
Even if you agree that the advice would have been different based on information that's not even evidence, I dispute that, but I'll take your point. And even if you assume that the advice would have been different, conspicuously absent from this petition is any affidavit from Bethel himself. And that is a notable gap in this petition. If we're going to talk about, well, gosh, if I had known this information, then I wouldn't have given the proffer, that's information that only Bethel can provide, and they didn't provide any affidavit from Bethel. So I think that alone defeats any speculative notion that Bethel would not have entered into the proffer had he known about the ATF report in summary 86.
What about the affidavits from his attorneys?
But again,
or the testimony from his attorneys?
About how they would have advised Mr. Bethel differently?
Correct.
Well, again, they can give the advice differently, but it boils down to what would Bethel have decided. Only Bethel can decide whether he was going to enter into that proffer. We need an affidavit from Bethel himself to even go down that road of speculation, and we don't even have that. That's a conspicuous absence in this petition. Not only does the absence of Bethel's affidavit constitute a failure to prove Bethel's own lack of knowledge, which I talked about a little bit earlier, but it also fails to prove that the
trial would have proceeded differently by way of not going into the proffer or any of that, any of those matters. But to bring back to the point, though, the statements themselves have no independent evidentiary value. It's the information conveyed in the statements that are allegedly exculpatory. Bethel knows that information because the information themselves puts Bethel at the scene as the driver. That's more than just knowledge of his non-involvement. That's knowledge of the specific exculpatory information that he's now relying on. Bethel knew that information. He had a choice. He could have, he knew that information all along. He could have, from the very beginning, said, I'm not going to enter into a proffer. I'm not going to confess to the crimes. I'm going to testify and tell the jury that that I was a driver and Langbein and Chavis were the shooters. He chose not to do that. He chose to enter into the proffer. And I don't see how that choice would be any different just because he knows of these two statements that have no independent evidentiary value on their own.
Counsel, do you believe he was the driver? Is that?
No, no, I don't believe that at all. But I think if you're going to look at their exculpatory evidence, then you, and decide.
So you're saying that that would have had to be the logical response of the defense if the contents of these inadmissible statements were somehow brought to trial, brought into the trial? Is that he could have.
He had a choice. If their new exculpatory theory is true, again, we dispute that, of course, but if their exculpatory theory is true, then you would also have to believe that Bethel himself knew of that information and specifically chose not to present it to the jury by way of his testimony. He chose to enter into the proffer instead, and he chose to present a fraudulent alibi. And on top of all that, too. So he
made the proffer, and then he entered into a plea agreement, and then he ended up going to trial anyways. But he stated that he thought the proffer couldn't be used against him at trial, which we know isn't true. So the proffer just seems like he didn't have a good understanding of what it was.
I reject that, Your Honor. This court has said in the direct appeal opinion that he entered into that proffer knowingly, voluntarily. He knew the consequences of that proffer. He knew the consequences of refusing to testify against Jeremy Chavis. That issue has been settled. So I don't think that comes into the analysis at all. But the basic failure here is that defense failed to prove that the defendant himself was unaware of the information contained in the statements. That alone blows up the Brady claim. And for related reasons, they can't prove materiality either, because again, the statements themselves have no independent evidentiary value. And let me phrase it this way. The 10th District, looking at the Williams statement in the 2010 opinion, already held that that statement is not material. 10th District held that, and that would be the law of the case. So the question is, does the Williams information combined with the Withers information somehow in combination amount to a finding of materiality? And again, I point back to the fact that the Withers statement is inadmissible hearsay. It adds nothing. So whether you combine them, looking at them one at a time, or what, however you want to look at it, the bottom line is the statements themselves have no independent evidentiary value. The defense cites this court's decision in State versus Brown as saying that hearsay can ultimately be Brady material. I agree with that if you can show that the hearsay would have led to something that's admissible. And Brown talks about that. The Brown talks about how the hearsay would have led the defense attorneys into calling the declarants as witnesses at the stand. We don't have that in this case. We don't have any theory as to how these statements would have led to anything actually admissible at trial, other than if the defendant himself would have gotten on the stand and testified to the information of him being the driver and Langbein and Chavis being the shooters. But he chose not to do that.
But you do agree, though, that had those statements been provided by the police to the prosecutor's office, that those would have been shared, that they clearly were Brady material and they would have been shared, correct?
I don't agree with that. They're not Brady material because Brady requires that the information have some evidentiary value. Inadmissible evidence is not Brady material. Woods versus Bartholomew talks about that.
Who determines admissibility, the court or you?
The court does, but I mean, but I can just cite to their hearsay rules that these statements would not be admissible.
But wouldn't we rather the state err on the side of supplying them and not suppressing them?
Well, again, I don't think the defense actually proved that the state suppressed the information in the statements. But even if you find that they did, again, we dispute that, but even if you find that they did, Brady still requires that the evidence be admissible at trial, and they cannot make that finding, and so we don't even have a Brady issue at all. They can't show suppression of information unknown to the defense. They can't show materiality because it has no independent evidentiary value. They can't show that that even if they did know, that the defendant would not have still entered into that proffer, because we don't have any affidavit from the defendant himself. All those things would blow up the Brady claim. I want to spend a very brief moment talking about res judicata. We all know res judicata applies to all post-conviction proceedings. It bars a defendant from raising any claim that was or could have been raised in a prior proceeding. That means if it is in fact true that the defense had this information back in 2008 pursuant to that public records request, at least the Withers information, then res judicata would bar them from presenting that now in 2018 after having already filed a motion for new trial with the Williams information. The defense cites the Walmart case that talks about a justice exception to res judicata. The one point I'll make about Walmart is that the court itself talks about that exception being very limited to the facts of that case. In that case, the party who was invoking res judicata, which was Walmart, they were responsible for the other side for not presenting the claim in a timely way. And so that's why this court refused to allow Walmart to invoke res judicata. I know the defense wants to blame the state for a lot of things here, but if it is true that the defense had the Withers statement in 2008, and by all indications, it seems like it is, they have not refuted that, it is not the state's fault that it took the defense until 2018 to actually get around to filing a petition and a motion for new trial based on the Withers information. That's not the state's fault. So the justice exception talked about in Walmart wouldn't bar the state from relying on res judicata in this case.
Counsel, the trial court found, the trial court found that the defense was not prevented from interviewing Withers and Chavis. I mean, they were presumably available to be interviewed, correct?
Right.
And that didn't happen.
We don't know.
Well, they weren't brought to the trial to testify.
They were on the state's witness list. Withers was, in fact, listed as his name was on the list, on the witness list, and his address was listed as a Franklin County jail. The defense attorneys and their affidavits, they claim to have no idea who Withers is and never heard of him and so on and so forth. I think the credibility of those types of statements is questionable given that he was on the witness list. And this is not to say that just putting someone's name on a witness list is per se compliance with Brady. I get that. But it's a very relevant piece of information when we're trying to prove what the defense knew and didn't know. When the names are on the witness list, the defense has to present some really solid evidence as to why the defense team would not have followed through and interviewed those witnesses, and they just haven't done that. But beyond all that, again, I'll just circle back to where I started. Even if you do agree that the defense presented evidence that the lawyers and investigators didn't know of this information, if you agree with that, you still have the basic problem that the defendant himself was aware of the information, because the content of the information proves that. The defendant was the driver. He would have known that. He could have presented that to the jury. He chose instead to give a fraudulent alibi.
Thank you.
Judgment should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. Troutman, what about the my last exchange with the state?
Regarding the fact that Mr. Bethel should have known about it?
Well, no, the fact that you had witnesses. Where were they at trial?
Well, first of all, the state does not meet its burden by providing a list of 365 names on a witness list.
Pardon me?
The state does not meet its burden under Brady by providing a list of 365 names and then having the defendant have to interview 361 of them. But also, we know from the facts of this case that you couldn't just force them to talk to you. I know for a fact, and that's part of
were
the
they
record.
No, you can't force them to talk to you, but there's no indication that they were even interviewed, that there was any activity by the defense team to, find out who Withers was. And Chavis was available, right?
Yes, Your Honor. It doesn't look like Chavis was willing to come forth and testify that he and Donald Langbein
whether or not he was willing to come forth and testify, I think the question is, was there any effort to interview him in prep for the trial?
Yes, it does appear that that defense counsel, at least the first set of defense counsel, talked to Mr. Chavis. I don't know the extent of those conversations based on the fact that he was also facing his own trial. But I think what's important there is again, that due diligence shift. It's the state's requirement to provide exculpatory information, favorable exculpatory information. It's not the—
Well, what about the fact that this is hearsay and, according to the state, inadmissible and therefore not Brady?
Well, this is what this court said in State versus Brown. Admittedly, these statements contained in these reports are hearsay and might not be admissible. However, they are material, and even if the defense could not directly introduce them at trial, the state's failure to turn them over was highly prejudicial.
There's two ways that Brady information could be material, right? One way is it could be admissible evidence. The other way is it could lead you— it may not be admissible, but it could still be material because it might lead the defense to conduct more of an investigation to find something out, right?
Yes.
So, but here, the information is not admissible, at least not for the truth. It's double hearsay. And as the state points out, it doesn't tell you— if you believe that theory, it doesn't tell you anything new that the defendant already didn't know. So it doesn't fit into either one of those boxes, right?
The defendant had no knowledge that there were two unbiased, independent witnesses that would have backed up what he had said.
If the theory is correct that he was the driver, then he did know that there were two witnesses.
He had no idea about Ronald Withers and Shannon Williams, that Jeremy Chavis told Ronald Withers that he and his cousin committed the crime. He had no idea that Donald Langbein told Shannon Williams that he committed this crime with a guy who was in prison in Kentucky, which was Jeremy Chavis.
But the substance of who the witnesses were, he knew if he was the driver, right?
He wouldn't know anything about Ronald Withers and Shannon Williams. They had nothing. They were in jail with Jeremy Chavis.
Right, but that's not evidence that could be admitted at trial. But the substance of what could come into trial, he knew about.
What Mr. Bethel knew— if Mr. Bethel knew— all innocent defendants know that they didn't commit the crime. So that can't be the standard. But it's about what you can prove. And Mr. Bethel's own self-serving testimony or own self-serving admission about where he was and what he saw wasn't going to get the jury to where they need to be, like these two witnesses would have.
But if his theory is true, he knew those witnesses were out there, which is all the statement would have given him, because the statement couldn't be admitted at trial anyway.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Nothing that he would have known about Ronald Withers and Shannon Williams.
That's not the point, right? The point is what substantive evidence he could have gotten from those statements that he could admit at trial.
Right, and I think my point is that the power of those statements was in who made them, and that these were independent people who had no skin in the game.
Ms. Troutman, what about the state's contention and point that it's made numerous times that your client submitted no affidavit, that he would have chosen differently had he had different advice from his attorney in terms of the proffer and the plea agreement, and then what happened after that?
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Bethel has testified under oath twice that he would not have given the proffer if he hadn't felt like he was compelled to do so because he was on the eve of trial with unprepared attorneys. It strains credulity to believe that he wouldn't, that he still would have given the proffer had he been in that situation and had exculpatory evidence. So no, he's disputed all along that he ever wanted to give the proffered statement to begin with. And he only did, the record's very clear that he did it on the advice of his attorneys, his mother, his investigator, his mitigation specialist. And then he tried to withdraw that, or he refused to testify against Mr. Chavis.
Counselor, where is the testimony? You're saying he testified twice that he would not have given that proffer.
At the suppression hearing that occurred in September 2002, as well as at trial when he took the stand in his own defense.
And then the question about from the state argues that in the context of all the testimony that Mr. Bethel was aware of what was in the ATF statement in summary 86. You've talked about all the conflicting evidence at trial. So how do we sort that out?
Well, I think the focus should be on what the standard is. And the standard is undermine confidence in the outcome. And remember, again, we do not have to prove that he would have been acquitted. But we need to look at all of the evidence that came in at trial and what the defense would have done with it had they known at the time, at the beginning. And so even if that evidence would not have come in, even if there was zero way that it would have been admissible at trial, what the defense would have done with it, as we know from their affidavits, is they would not have advised him to plead guilty, and they would not have advised him to make that proffered statement. And I can't stress enough that I don't think these prosecutors had that evidence. The state now wants to kind of diminish the value of these reports. But when you look at the suppression hearing on August 16th, 2002, the state told the court and defense counsel that they provided all the exculpatory evidence they had and explained that they had a report of some guy bragging that he had committed the crime, but he had passed a polygraph test. That to them was enough that it needed to be turned over.
If I remember correctly, the proffer was an agreement where he agreed that if he didn't abide by its terms, everything in it would be admissible at trial against him, correct?
That was the signed agreement, yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Mr. Gilbert is right that this court has already decided the issue of the voluntariness of the proffer, but I do think it's relevant to think about it in terms of, I mean, he was 3 months past his 18th birthday at the time of the crime, that he was on the eve of trial with two attorneys who were not prepared, and to consider all of that, as the jury was told, you know, as he testified, to kind of put his own proffered statement in context in light of this new evidence. Because it does diminish the value, just like in Gum versus Mitchell, Sixth Circuit case where the court found a Brady violation, but the defendants there had a confession. But the court still found that it was material.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision.
Thank you, Your Honors.